Excision number 12433, reel 4.
Mr. Holbrow, reel 4.
Right. Although I decided not to make a serious attempt to escape, for my own morale, I decided to enliven the monotony. I did feel that I should take certain risks. So one dark night, in company with a Welsh guardsman, Taffy Lawrence, we broke out of camp and met two pretty Polish girls by arrangement. The guards locked us in our huts at night, and being a small camp, they didn't patrol the outer fence. With my outside connections with the Poles, and with the help of tins of Red Cross coffee, I'd been able to obtain some wire cutters and also a civilian Trilby hat, a duplicate key to the hut. We let ourselves out of the hut and cut the barbed wire security fence in a number of places. This was the trickiest part, but we were not disturbed and met the two girls out on the main road. It was a pitch black night, and we made our way across fields to where the tramway ran and sat down in a passenger shelter to rest and talk. My girlfriend was named Ellie, and we were getting on famously when we heard voices which belonged to several German soldiers in uniform. They were not, however, on duty, but apparently waiting for a tram, and seemed very interested in discovering us four in the shelter. Taffy and I were both wearing our brown British Army denim overalls, buttoned up to the neck, with civilian hats, and if questioned, would make out we were foreign civilian workers, of which there were many in Germany. I think the soldiers spoke to us all in German, and the Polish girls replied in German with some light-hearted banter. Anyway, the girls grabbed our arms and hurried us away back across the fields. They were absolutely terrified, as they faced very severe punishment if caught with prisoners of war. It was also obvious that our night of romance was over, so we hastily said goodbye to the camp, where we not only had to get through the barbed wire again, but also to repair it so the Germans wouldn't see it the following day, and note that it had been cut. The other chaps in the hut had all waited up to hear our experience, but I think they were rather discouraged from making similar attempts.
So this is Danzig you're talking
about? Yes, still at Danzig, yeah, 2.5 years.
How had you got in touch with those Polish girls?
They worked in the same firm as us, you see. They worked in the same firm as us.
So I mean, yes,
it was quite easy, yes. There were guards there, but they... You know, they couldn't be everywhere at once, and so on. But the real German girls wouldn't have shopped us. But these were what are known as Karschuben Poles. They were Poles who had been partially of German extraction. Some of them had German names, you know, but they didn't know really whether they were Poles or not, or Germans. The Germans told them they were Poles and called them up for the army and everything, you know. Yeah. I talk about that a bit later. We had all hoped to see the war out at Danzig because, as working camps go, it had turned out to be one of the best. And after 2.5 years, we were a tightly knit community and had hammered out good working conditions with the Germans, almost in the style of a British trade union.
How did you do that?
By, working hard at times and then gradually negotiating, almost like piecework, negotiating times for certain operations. But
just informally, or did you have an organisation?
No, informally. I think that Druckenmiller, the civilian employer, finally realised he was being taken for a ride and decided to clear out all the British POWs and replace with Russian POWs who they could and did treat abominably. Anyway, in October 1943, we were suddenly told to pack up as we were all being sent to a sugar factory just starting production at Marienburg, which was the location of our main Stalag 20B camp. The day before we left, the wheel of a heavy cart loaded with iron girders had run over my foot, which was now very swollen. When we got to the sugar factory after a long train journey, it was apparent that the factory was just like the one at Neuteich, where I had worked in 40 to 41. And according to prisoners already there, conditions were very bad. I therefore went sick with my foot, and the civilian doctor was so impressed with the swelling, he decided I would be useless in the factory and sent me to the main Stalag 20B, where I'd suffered in the winter of 1941. Fortunately, due to the Germans now losing the war, conditions were now very much better here. Although I couldn't work, I could manage on the daily camp rations, augmented with Red Cross food parcels. But my health was deteriorating. I had a bad cold and cough I couldn't shake off, and I'd lost a lot of weight. About that time, they'd installed an X-ray screening machine in the POW hospital at Marienburg, and I decided to have a check-up. TB was very common among prisoners of war due to the years of insufficient nutritious diet, overwork and cramped living conditions. I was screened with about 12 others and my heart beat wildly when I was the only one kept behind. I was told I had TB of the right lung and would have to stay in hospital. They had my belongings brought from the camp, and I was put in a TB ward with about 10 others. That evening, the British MO, a captain or major, gave me a physical overhaul and confirmed the German diagnosis. He said I would be kept in hospital at Marienburg for some weeks, and then taken to POW TB sanatorium at Elsterhorst in Saxony, where they had specialists and all facilities. He was guardedly optimistic about a recovery, but said I would eventually have to go before a medical board of Germans and the Swiss protecting power, which would lead to repatriation back to England. I really didn't have much hope at that stage, as there were several seriously ill patients and one dying in my room. I had dreadful night sweats, and some of the orderlies did their best to frighten one concerning your high daily temperatures and pulse readings, sputum tests, etc. The food was good, and you were not allowed out of bed, so my weight began to improve.
You mean the orderlies did that out of sadistic reasons?
No, I think they wanted to make sure that we stayed there and lay absolutely quiet and didn't take any liberties, you know. The worst patient died after a week of coughing, and another one, a champion swimmer and diver from Northern Ireland, was so ill he had to be removed to the sanatorium urgently. Just before Christmas 1943, we were taken to another POW hospital some distance away. I presume to make room for new arrivals. We spent a miserable Christmas, and early in the new year, 1944, were taken to the TB sanatorium at Elsterhorst in Saxony. This was a huge hospital in the countryside, very much like the area around Aldershot, all sandy and coniferous and so on. There were POWs of every nationality, including a lot of Indian soldiers. The POW chief medical officer was an Australian colonel who made a name carrying out major chest surgery. Over him was a German officer consultant who was a very decent type. My MO was a South African captain named Kaywood. He told me that although my right lung was quite badly affected, he hoped that with rest and good food it would heal naturally. This was called conservative treatment. Other patients had to have their lungs artificially collapsed by an injection of air artificial pneumothorax, and an even more serious operation, which involved the removal of ribs. This was before the discovery of streptomycin, when TB was a very serious illness. At first, I was put in a room to myself, which made me think. But after a few weeks, I began to improve, and was put into a very large ward. Here there was so much going on and so many different types and nationalities to converse with that the time went quickly. And even though I was still confined to bed, the food, all from Red Cross supplies, was very good. We had plenty of books to read, and I first started playing bridge here with some regular soldiers. A medical board came to the hospital about this time, but I was not selected to appear. One of my friends, George Corston, did so and was passed for repatriation. This was very exciting, as I expected to be on the next board in a few months' time. George and his girlfriend kindly visited my mother after his arrival in England and gave her all my news. He subsequently married the lady and they took the general stores on the main road at Bentley Hants. But when I called some years later, they had moved. About midsummer 1944, for no apparent reason, about 30 of us bed patients were suddenly moved to a small hospital in a lovely countryside not far away. We received no medical treatment and were allowed to get up and roam around the grounds of the very large house. I remember it was a golden summer. The corn was ripe, the poppies in flower, and the lime trees in full blossom. There were also English POWs to talk to who had been recently wounded and captured at Anzio, who were able to give us up-to-date news of the war and tell us about the Americans in England and the battlefronts. While here, I wove a small tapestry in the shape of an RE badge, which I now have framed in my bedroom. I also won a bridge competition in partnership with a Scots regular soldier who was something of an expert. After a few weeks without explanation, we were returned to the sanatorium at Elsterhorst, and as I had suffered no ill effects from my recent activity, I was allowed to walk around the grounds of the hospital during exercise periods. I was duly selected for the next medical board. The German and Swiss doctors looked at my x-rays and had no hesitation in approving my repatriation, which was a great relief. But the war was now hitting the Germans so badly after D-Day and the Russian offensives, but most of all from the Allied bombing of their cities it seemed doubtful if and when they would be able to arrange another repatriation of POWs. Fortunately for me, I was on the next repatriation, which took place in September 1944. I said goodbye to Elsterhorst, where I'd been bedridden for 9 months, and was thankful for the correct and good treatment I had received under difficult conditions. I travelled on a passenger train in a reserve coach with an armed guard. We only moved at night, and there were numerous stops and diversions due to Allied bombing and to pick up other repatriates. I don't know the route we took, but I think we went via Berlin. We were in the train 2 or 3 nights, and we slept with our legs right across the seats. One morning I awoke to find an Indian officer seated uncomfortably at one end of the seat with my feet on his lap. We eventually arrived at the Baltic port of Sassnitz, where a large number of POWs were assembled for repatriation. We were put aboard a Swedish railway ferry and waved goodbye to Germany as we sailed out of the harbour. On the ship were a large number of American prisoners, the first we had encountered. They brought us up to date with all the latest jazz and dance music. One GI who couldn't control his sexual urges on seeing a woman after so long assaulted one of the Swedish girls on board, but was overpowered by the other prisoners before it became too serious. The crossing to the Swedish port of Trelleborg was soon accomplished, and we then boarded an electric train which took us up to Stockholm and then back to the port of Gothenburg. The Swedes welcomed us with open arms, and I would like to have spent longer in their country untouched by war. At Gothenburg we boarded the Swedish American liner Gripsholm and were immediately plunged into unaccustomed luxury. We had individual cabins with stewards and the full menu of a transatlantic liner. The liner was escorted by German destroyers as far as the Norwegian port of Kristiansand, which was under German occupation, but that was the last we saw of them. Our route was a very wide circle round the Shetlands, and we saw no other shipping, but the weather got very rough, especially round the north of Scotland, and the ship was subject to a beam roll, and we all became very seasick. I didn't move from my bed for 2 days and couldn't face the lovely food the steward kept bringing to my cabin. We eventually moved into calmer waters and were able to enjoy the liner's amenities for a few days more. We arrived at Liverpool and were welcomed at the quayside by a rather corny American military band. We were then put on a hospital train and pulled out of Liverpool when it was dark, the blackout being in full operation. As we waited in the station, it was wonderful to hear female English voices for the first time for 5 years, even though they belonged to Liverpool teenagers seeing off their sailor boyfriends. A train arrived at the Olympia station in West London in the early hours, while still very dark. We were transferred in coaches driven by lady drivers, which was something we had never seen before. These took us to the Royal Herbert Hospital in Woolwich, where we were welcomed and put to bed by pretty nurses. Hardly had we closed our eyes when there was a terrible explosion, which turned out to be a V-2 rocket landed close by. The following days, I was given methodical medical examinations and x-rays, which seemed to confirm that my lung had healed well, leaving a very definite scar. The doctor said I would be able to go home in a few days' time. Meanwhile, my parents had been in touch with me by telephone, and my mother and sister made the long journey from Slough in Bucks by train to spend a few hours with me at the hospital. It was a very happy reunion, but I hardly recognised my sister, who had grown from a young girl to a young woman since we had last met. My father was not there because he was now a garrison engineer for the war department and couldn't get away. They gave me all the news, saddest part of which for me was our wire-haired fox terrier Patch had had to be put down due to old age and chronic illness. A few days later, a number of us were taken to the mainline termini in London, where I made my own way home from Paddington to Slough. Although still under wartime conditions, very strict food rationing, it was wonderful to be home again. I was given extended leave with pay and rations, amounting to 10 shillings a day. Eventually demobilised with 100% war disability pension, at that time £2.08 a week. I also received 4 years back pay, about £120, from the army, and a gratuity amounting to £32. In order to be measured and fitted out for my civilian demob suit, I had to make several visits to Aylesbury, which involved a roundabout rail journey, changing trains 3 times, and in the end, the trousers were 6 inches too long, which was unbelievable considering my height of 6'6". It was now late in 1944. Of course, the war was far from over. I listened agonised to the radio accounts of the Arnhem disaster and the Battle of the Bulge in the Ardennes, and then with great satisfaction to the crossing of the Rhine and the final defeat of the Germans. I stayed out all night near Buckingham Palace to watch the VE Day parade the next day. As soon as the war was over, I was contacted by two of my POW friends, Titch Shaun and Taffy Bruton. Titch came to stay for the weekend at Slough and told me of his hair-raising experiences when he was liberated by the Russians in Poland. There had been bloody battles in Marienburg and near all our POW camps. The Allied prisoners were given no help at all to leave the battle zones by the Russians. And it had been rather like our march when taken prisoner by the Germans in France in 1940, except that the Russians appeared more predictable and dangerous than the Germans.
More predictable?
Unpredictable than the Germans. He felt he was lucky to get home alive and was warned by the British authorities not to talk about his experiences, for presumably for fear of upsetting our allies, the Russians. Taffy Bruton and I met in Windsor with our wives, both present, and we had a few hours with plenty to talk about. After I became ill, he had been transferred to an NCO's camp in Germany and was fortunate in being liberated by the armies of the West. After VE Day 1945, I applied to go on the Central Commission, the Control Commission of Germany, and I attended an interview in London where my knowledge of German was tested and I was offered a very remunerative post in Germany to start immediately. However, after due consideration, I decided I'd been away from home too long already, so I turned down the offer. As my health remained good, my disability pension was reduced each year until 1956, when it was terminated altogether with a gratuity of £60. In July 1976, my wife and I enjoyed a coach holiday in Poland. We went by air to Danzig Airport and stayed in Danzig for about 3 days, exploring the old town and visiting Zopet and Gdynia. My old camp at Danzig had, of course, disappeared, but one or two warehouses and the railway sidings where we worked were still in operation. Nobody spoke German, so I was not able to learn very much about what happened when the Russians overran the city in 1945, but I imagine not many Germans lived to tell the tale. The next place we visited was Malbork, Marienburg in German, where I'd spent my unhappy days at Stalag 20B, as previously described. Again, I could find no trace of the huge prison camp and the hospital, but we explored the famous castle of the Teutonic Knights, which I had always admired from the outside when a prisoner. And as we left the town on the way to Thorn, our next port of call, I saw a war cemetery. I asked the Polish driver, with whom I was very friendly, to stop. He agreed, but a lot of the British tourists objected. However, I got my way and a few of them joined my wife and I in a walk round the cemetery. It was a moving and sad experience for me as we saw the graves of a number of prisoners of war I'd known personally and also those of the brave RAF crews of the Lancasters that we had seen shot down on the air raid to Danzig in 1943. All the British had individual graves, well kept, but the many Russians and Germans who had died in the subsequent local land battles were all buried in common graves. Towards the end of our holiday, we found ourselves within a few hours' drive of Auschwitz concentration camp. Once again, our fellow travellers were not interested in anything to do with the war, so my wife and I hired a private car to take us there and wait a couple of hours while we walked through the whole camp. This was an unforgettable and harrowing experience and made me thankful that as a prisoner of war, I had been relatively well treated compared with the inmates of this notorious death camp.
Do you think that your experiences in the war, in particular as a POW, changed you very much? Obviously, you got the TB, but in your attitudes and so on?
I'll tell you one thing. It made me... I never waste any food. I cannot bear to see food wasted. I love bread and the staple things, you know, and it just hurts me to see the way people waste food these days.